I think that it's really important to point out that the relationship between a draft of a book and a finished book is not unlike the relationship between a seed and a watermelon. So when I talk about having a draft, what I have is a pile full of grammatical mistakes, continuity errors, misspellings, unfinished scenes. It's a disaster, but it exists.
Hello, I'm Hattie Crissell. This is In Writing, and that was today's guest, the novelist Ruman Alam. Ruman started his career in magazine journalism and then worked in advertising before his first novel, Rich and Pretty, was published in 2016. That was followed by That Kind of Mother in 2018, but he's probably best known now for Leave the World Behind. His third book, which came out in 2020, was critically acclaimed and became a finalist in the National Book Awards. There was a bidding war over the screen rights to the novel, and they were eventually bought by Netflix. As far as I'm aware, the movie version isn't in production yet, but the latest reports say that it will star Julia Roberts and Mahershala Ali, so quite exciting. If you haven't read Leave the World Behind, it's a tale about a middle-class family from New York who head off to the Hamptons for a week's holiday in a rental house. You're probably picturing a certain kind of book now. It's not that kind of book, so brace yourself. A couple of days into their stay, the owners of the house show up out of the blue, and there's been a power cut in New York, so they didn't know where else to go. None of them can now get online or access any news to find out what's going on with the power cut. And from there, the book descends into some pretty spooky, sinister, creepy stuff. I won't say any more, but I found it a very unsettling, quite addictive read, and definitely one of those books that you think about all day in between reading sessions. Ruman and I also talk a little bit about the length of the book. It's quite slim, which I love, and we do get into that. And I just want to say as a disclaimer that I also think very long books can be wonderful, and there are some writers who I just want them their books to go on forever because they're so good. So I'll just say that now before I start being quite rude about long books later in this episode. I've been careful in the editing of this conversation with Ruman to avoid spoilers, so it should be safe to listen to even if you haven't read the book. But we do talk about some of the elements of the writing that I found very effective and how he approached them. We spoke at the beginning of October. Ruman was at the home that he shares with his husband and two kids in Brooklyn, and I found him really outspoken and funny and interesting. He talked about how his novels come together in the editing, how well-chosen metaphors and images can create a particular atmosphere in your work, and how he managed to maintain a huge central mystery in his novel without frustrating his readers. One quick warning, there are a few F words scattered through this interview. Before we get to that, this episode is sponsored by The Novelry, the online writing school founded by Booker-listed author Louise Dean with an in-house team of published authors and professional editors. The Novelry offers courses, one-to-one coaching and community to take you all the way from your first draft to submitting a polished manuscript to literary agents. If you've always wanted to write, or maybe you've started a story but haven't managed to finish, then personal guidance from The Novelry could help you reach the end. You'll enjoy one-to-one coaching from a published author at the top of their game and workshops from best-selling writers to inspire, inform and keep you on track. The Novelry is offering a 20% discount on their online writing course, The Big Idea, for listeners of this podcast. This short course is perfect for beginners or writers in need of fresh inspiration who would like to write a page-turning story. Enter the code INWRITING20 at checkout on thenovelry.com or simply book a free chat to discuss your writing and find out more and finish that story that you've always wanted to write. But now, over to Ruman.
I'm not someone who is too precious about the circumstances under which I write, and I think that that's just kind of modern life. You know, certainly a couple of years ago, my life was very different, as most of our lives were. I had to be someone who could write on the subway or taking my kids to the dentist's office or, you know, sitting at the playground with a stack of papers in my lap. So I am kind of that sort of peripatetic writer.
Yeah.
And with respect to Leave the World Behind, I wrote a lot of that book in sort of sustained bursts in a hotel room. I stayed in a hotel room, I think, for 5 days in January of 2018. Oh, no, 2019, that would have been. And then again at the end of that month for another 4 or 5 days. And when I was revising it, I stayed in other hotel rooms. Whenever I say that, I feel like people are imagining Eloise at the Plaza or something. It was not like that at all. It was, these were, perfectly fine hotel rooms, but not the kinds of hotels where you could get room service and, get a spa bath or something like that. It was much more down and dirty. So I'm not someone who's like too concerned with the place I find myself when I'm writing.
Yeah. But when you are at home, you are that room that you're in right now would be the place.
It's the place. It's my office. It's a tiny little, we live in a tiny little house in Brooklyn, and it's quite narrow. So the front room and the back room on the upstairs are the bedrooms. And in between those two, there's a little tiny interior room that is where my husband and I have our dresser and where I have my desk and some percentage of my books sort of stacked up all around me.
Right, okay. So does that mean you have no windows in that room?
I have no windows. I have a little skylight. So in the summertime, it's a little bit like being a rotisserie chicken or something. Like you're being cooked from above by the summer sun. But again, when you live in a city, space is at a premium. And so I think you'll sort of take whatever little corner you can grab. And it's suited me really well. It used to be, it was the nursery when my younger son was an infant. But since my boys have been sharing a room, so for past 9 years or so, it's been my office.
Yeah. And so you said you're surrounded by a lot of books. Is that the kind of main, if you were going to describe the scenery, is that the main feature?
Well, we have a kind of exuberant house. So I have a very colorful patterned wallpaper behind me that has these illustrations of costumes, of ballet costumes from Russia.
That sounds beautiful.
And it's really beautiful. It's a beautiful wallpaper. And I have a lot of art. A lot of art that I've bought over the years that's really meaningful to me has ended up in this room. And so I have. Gosh, I'm just looking around. I have like three really beautiful paintings, a really beautiful drawing by an artist named Zylor Jane. I have some pictures that my children have drawn me. One of the indulgences when I sold my book to Bloomsbury in the UK was that I bought from an auction house in London a pencil portrait of the writer Anita Bruckner. And it's an absolutely beautiful portrait. It was a preparatory drawing for a portrait that was painted by her by a Hungarian painter named, gosh, I'm not going to say her name correctly. Her name is Zsuzsi Robos. And she died a few years ago. And this was part of her estate. This is part of her archive. And it's a really beautiful, quite big charcoal sketch of Anita Bruckner's face. And that's sort of looming over me as I write, which is sort of like a high pressure situation for any writer.
That's lovely. And you were saying just before we started that you're moving house at the moment.
I am. So I'm not, I'm, I work at home, and my husband, who's a photographer, also works at home. And we, the children, as they are wont to do, just keep growing. And we realized this little tiny house was starting to feel a little tight. And I thought maybe it would alleviate some of the pressure if I got my books out of here. And so I put some percentage of them in storage, and then I realized that there was an apartment available in the neighborhood, and we rented it. And I'm moving my office there. My husband's moving his office there, and I think it's going to be huge for my ability to work because, at the moment, for the past, goodness, I published my first book in 2016. So since 2015. Really, I've been writing fiction and writing criticism and journalism, essentially as a full-time job. But I've been doing it here in the house. And as I think many people can relate to with their experience of working from home over the past 15 months or so, it's very easy to slip from doing your work to doing the laundry or
Yeah.
making dinner or, making sure the beds are changed or whatever task needs to be done. There's always something that does need to be done. And I think that leaving the house, unlocking a different door, sitting down at a desk and being unable to distract myself from the work at hand, I'm really hoping that that will change my relationship to the work that I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I think that sounds really exciting. So you'll have your house that you live in, and then what, within walking distance, this other apartment
exactly.
where you'll both go and work.
Absolutely.
Sounds like a dream come true, really.
It is a bit of a fantasy come true. I think there's a kind of like legendary story that may well be urban myth, I'm not sure, about Helena Bonham Carter and
yes.
Tim Burton living in separate homes. And I think that many people who are long married and happily married even can relate to how appealing that sounds, the idea of being able to like at the end of dinner say, okay, I'm going to my own home now, I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that's sort of how I feel about my work. The idea of having an office and being able to, I think it's a way of sort of taking my own work a little more seriously, which I'm excited about.
Yeah. And are you writing a book at the moment?
Oh, Hattie, that is such a good question. I am writing a book. And it is a challenge at the moment because I've reached a point, and this has come with my three previous books too, I've reached the point where the preparatory work is at an end. And what I need to do is immerse myself in it. And unfortunately, my schedule is not cooperating.
Right.
My children have just gone back to school for the first time in, you know, quite a while. And so, and of course, we're undertaking this big move. And so there are all these other sort of life tasks interfering. But my hope is that by the middle or end of October, I will be able to really just drop into the deep end of the book. And I tend to think through things for some period of time. Sometimes it's pretty long. It can even be a couple of years. My first book, I remember when I was putting away all of the notebooks associated with my first book, I found notes about those characters from 3 or 4 years before I ever wrote the book. So I do have this sort of long runway. And then what I like to do is just sort of plunge in. And often I think I do so much thinking or I do so much scratching in a notebook or whatever that by the time I sit down to write, it does come very quickly.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping, I'm going to jinx myself by saying this out loud to you, but I'm hoping that that will be the experience.
So talk to me a little bit more about that preparatory work. So you said you had notes on the characters that went back a long time. So is character where you tend to start?
It can be character. It can be sort of fixing them in time is also usually very important to me. Understanding, I'm terrible at math. So understanding, you know, what their age is, what the year is, and what that means about what year in which they would have been born, what that means about who was the president when they were born, who is the president in the moment that the book is unfolding. What are the conditions of the culture? Has the iPhone been invented? Has Instagram been invented? What do I need to, what is within the book's purview as the book tries to talk about the reality of that moment? So thinking about all of that stuff. So I have a lot of like timelines and calendars that I try and figure out. So there's some element of that, figuring out what their names are going to be, and I spend a lot of time on that, changing my ideas about what their names are. My first editor, who was the editor on all three of my books, although she departed the house before my last book came out, she was very particular about names. And she said, I think it was her who said to me, in the United States, you can look up through the Social Security Administration the popularity of names in a given birth year.
Yeah.
And that really helps establish a sense of reality that, you know, a woman in 2021 who would have been born in 1985, what is her name? How can you figure out what her name might have been? Or what were the names of the girls that she was with in a classroom in second grade? It can be really helpful. So I do some of that. I think some amount of this writerly research is wasting time, and some amount of it is like letting your imagination wander and scratching out scenes. Or I do this other thing occasionally where I'll write in what I think is sort of like an almost an obituary mode, almost a journalistic mode about the life of one of the characters. And it's usually not the primary character, it's usually some associated character. And I just try and figure out their biography, birth to death, almost like a Wikipedia entry is a good way of thinking about it. And so I've done that for my new book. And that kind of stuff is all, I don't even know what you would call it. I mean, it's quite, saying it out loud, it sounds so crazy. And when I look at my notebooks, so much of this kind of gibberish would just be unintelligible to other people. But I think some of it, to some extent, it's about making them very real in my own imagination. So that when it's time to write about them, I know what their names are. I know, that they were born during the, Reagan administration. I know what their second grade teacher's name was, even if none of that material ends up in the finished fiction.
You know them as a person. I suppose
Right.
it's a little bit like if you were writing something about somebody you know. You know, you would be able to guess how they would behave in different situations because you know them. So I guess it's kind of the same principles.
It's, yeah, getting to know them or even writing about them sort of journalistically, because I think it's a funny thing because there's distance between me and this person, but at the same time there's no distance because I've made this person up. And so I can decide if I want them to have a name that was not popular in the year of their birth, according to the Social Security Administration, I can make that decision and I can justify it however I want. I can say, oh, well, this character's mother was a student abroad in France in the 1970s, and she met a boy named Christophe, and that's why she named her son Christopher, and that's the end of the story, and that's how I'm making sense of it to myself.
When do you first remember writing being something that was important to you?
Oh, forever, really forever. I was a very early reader as a kid. I had a babysitter. I was just like family lore, so it's always hard to know what's true and what's not true. But the story goes that a babysitter taught me to read when I was four, and I do think that some people are just sort of like predisposed to language as a tool. And again, I'm a parent now, and I see it with my own sons. My older son is still not that interested in reading. He's 12. And my younger son is extremely adept and has been for quite a while at language and reading, and his memory for, like, I'll read him novels. He's in fourth grade. I'll read him novels that are quite beyond his grade level, and he'll remember the details. We don't read on Fridays and Saturday nights. They're allowed to watch their iPads. So we'll read a book. We'll get to a certain point on Thursday and we'll pick it up on Sunday. And I'll say, okay, well, what was happening? And his ability to remember what was happening in the story astonishes me because I often can't remember because I'm reading other books too. And I can't hold on to that detail. Some people just have that predisposition, and I think that I did. And I think writing as a creative act is so interrelated to reading when you're very young. And I think a lot of kids, at least I sort of remember this for myself, you read books and then you think, oh, well, I can just write the kind of book that I want to read. And you start to do that. And I was doing that by the time I was seven, probably writing books, and reading a lot of adult books, strangely. I read a lot of like Agatha Christie mysteries and things like that when I was in third grade. I couldn't possibly have made heads or tails of them, but that's what I was doing. And so it's really been a lifelong relationship for me between reading and writing and the self.
Was it very clear to you from a young age that you were going to be a professional writer and that you were going to study creative writing?
It was, although I didn't really have a clear model for how that would be. My mother is a physician, my father is an architect. Like so many Asian immigrant families in this country, but really the world over, you're raised with a belief in professionalism. And my parents could comprehend being a physician or an architect or an engineer or a banker. They couldn't understand being a writer. I don't think they discouraged me. I don't think they entirely encouraged me either. I was really dogged about finding a way to do it. And ultimately, the way that I did it was I studied creative writing as an undergraduate. I went to Oberlin College in Ohio. I studied with a writer named Dan Shaun, who's an extraordinary novelist, who actually has a book coming out this spring called Sleepwalk that is incredible. And I thought, okay, I have this preparation in writing fiction, and what I will do is I'll work in publishing. And that is, in fact, what I did. I worked in magazines. So I found a way to professionalize my interests, which is a very good immigrant behavior, I think.
So at what point does your first novel start to take shape?
Well, so I graduated from college in 1999, and my first novel was published in 2016. So this is a significant gap of 17 years. And all through that period of 17 years, I would have considered myself privately a writer. I'm not sure I would have said that aloud to people, but I was writing. I was writing a lot of short stories. I was avoiding the temptation to apply to graduate school because I was so afraid that I would not get into a graduate program. And it also sounds so strange to say this to somebody in 2021, but this was before the internet really had taken hold as a consumer product. So I didn't even really understand how you applied to graduate school. Like I didn't have a sense of like, how would I go to the Iowa Writers Workshop? Yeah. How would I apply to Stanford? Like, I really didn't know. And I thought, oh, if it's graduate school, I'll have to take the GREs or something. I'm terrible at math. I'm terrible at standardized tests. I'll never be able to do it. I'll never get in anyway. Just forget it. So I sort of forgot it. I really wrestled with that for a while. But I was employed sort of on and off in magazines. I was able to make a living in this expensive city, which is not easy. I was able to get sort of the occasional freelance writing assignment, really writing about fashion or style. And that was I had a good run. I really did have a good run. And in 2008, I had a very dear friend who's just a couple years older than me. So kind of like a big sisterly type, who I had worked with at a magazine that is now defunct called Lucky. And she said to me that she was going to work in advertising. And she said, you have to go work in advertising. You're such a good writer. You can make so much money. And I was like, oh, you know, I was like, well, tell me more about the money. I'm very curious about this. And it was through her very, very generous introduction, because she was offered a job she was unable to take, working for an ad agency that's based in Minneapolis that worked at the time on fashion and style accounts for Target. And this woman said, you should take this job. I'm going to send you to see the creative director when they're in New York City, which they're shooting something, so they'll be here. And I went and met them, and I got that assignment, and the money was exponentially more than I was scratching out writing about. At the time, I was writing a lot about interiors. So I would be writing about, you know, a beautiful home or wallpaper or whatever. And then I got this assignment and I got like four times the amount of money to produce, you know, 10% of the labor. And so I started working in advertising. This was in 2008, right when the American economy kind of spun out of control and a lot of the magazines I was working with died. They were all, you know, they ceased publication. And then a year later, I became a father. And I was making a great living, writing television commercials, writing ad campaigns, talking to clients. It was a great living, and I was really happy. And my older son was probably two, and we had moved to the part of Brooklyn where we still live. And I had a play date with a friend of ours, who is also a novelist. Her name is Emma Straub. She's a well-known novelist. And she said something to me that I found so thoughtful, which was, because at the time I was still writing short stories, I was still sending them out. And Emma said to me, you know, no one is ever going to ask you to write a book. If you want to write a book, you just have to do it. And I found that really insightful. And I was 36 at the time, maybe 35. And I thought, I make a good living. We're happy, but I don't want to be 51 and regret never having tried. I don't want to have been privately waiting around for the invitation that, as Emma pointed out, would never arrive. And so I stopped working in advertising as much. I got a sort of great dream job working at New York Magazine, where I was editing the interior design issue, which is a standalone issue that came out twice a year. And like so much contemporary work, it was not a full-time job. It was a sort of gig job. And there was a hiatus of, I think, 12 weeks or 15 weeks between issues. And so I think by that time we had my second son. We did, definitely. And I said to my husband, okay, I am going to write a book, but I have to finish it before I go back to work. So I have 12 weeks. So I laid out all these very complicated circumstances to him. I was like, I will write every night. Like, you'll put the children to bed at 7, because my children were very obedient then and went to bed at 7 o'clock. and I'm going to sit downstairs in the living room at this little table, and you cannot speak to me, and you cannot ask me what I'm doing. And in the morning, you will have to get up with the kids, but I will take them to school, and then I'll come back and I'll figure out how I'm gonna like get through the day. And my husband, he's a good man, and he said, okay, that's fine. I won't speak to you from 7 p.m. for these 3 months. And that's exactly what I did. I would work from 7 p.m. until 2, wow, sometimes 3 in the morning. And then I would sometimes get up at 6 when the boys got up, feed them breakfast, take them to school, come home, fall asleep, obviously, because I was exhausted, and then get up around noon. I would make dinner. I would get the house in order. I would pick the boys up from school. I would be with them through dinner time, and he would put them to bed, and I would do it all over again. And it was extremely difficult, as you can imagine, although having children does really prepare you to survive without much sleep. But I produced a draft of the book in 3 months under these circumstances.
Presumably you'd already done a lot of the thinking that was going into that book.
Yes, I had. I think it had been, and again, I sort of think back now to what Emma said about the invitation. I think I was waiting for the invitation. I think I had the idea for the book, but how could anybody possibly know that? And how could that ever lead to anything without my actually putting that effort in? It's impossible, you know?
Yeah. I think it's really wise advice. But when you say that you had the idea for the book, what exactly do you mean by that? Did you have the whole plot worked out, or did you have a situation that you thought was interesting that you wanted to explore? You know, how much are we talking? How fleshed out an idea was it before you sat down to write?
I had in my head a dynamic between two invented women. The idea that there were these two women who were adults who were locked forever into a dynamic of friendship rooted in their girlhood, and that the dynamic pertained decades on. And the dynamic was that one of them was the daughter of great wealth and political power, and one of them was a scholarship girl at a very fancy private school who was really beautiful. And more than beautiful, had this sort of like the kind of innate charisma that you find sometimes in the wild that can be quite divorced from beauty, actually, that some people are pretty, but have this sort of propulsive charisma.
So you wrote that book quite quickly, and I did read somewhere as well that you wrote your first draft of Leave the World Behind in about 3 weeks. And I know you mentioned, you said something earlier about how you had like 5 days in a hotel here and then 5 days in a hotel there. And I'm sure that there are people listening to this who, for whom, you know, alarm bells would have rung when you said that, because it's like, are you actually saying that you wrote a book in 10 days of hotel time? But it sounds like you move very quickly once you start.
Well, you know, I think that it's really important to point out that the relationship between a draft of a book and a finished book is not unlike the relationship between a seed and a watermelon. So when I talk about having a draft, what I have is a pile full of grammatical mistakes, continuity errors, misspellings, you know, illogical things, unfinished scenes, dialogue that leads nowhere. You know, it's a disaster, but it exists. And in some ways, you can't actually begin the work until the draft exists. So on my first book, at the end of that 12-week haul, I had a pile of papers. And it was very key to me on both of those drafting experiences. Very key. I think this is like the smartest thing I've ever done, is that I didn't look back at what I had written. I simply plowed forward. And so I had sort of section breaks, or I had an outline. And at each section break, I would start a new Word document on my computer. So I was unable to look back at my own footprints in the snow, so to speak. It was the only way I could continue going. Because once you look back, you think, oh, I should change this character's name. Or, oh, actually, instead of breakfast, they should be at dinner. And, oh, actually, she should have a brother and his name should be Thomas. And I was unable to edit myself until I had the draft. Because I think it's so easy to get bogged down in that self-editing, because it's inevitable. You know what's coming. You know you've made mistakes. But it's about fooling yourself, or not fooling yourself, but pacing yourself to finish the whole race before you start to relitigate what you've just done.
Yeah, you know, you're trying to plow forward, but do you ever hit a wall of, I just don't know what should happen next? Where is this plot going? Or, you know, in the case of Leave the World Behind, you have a plot that is very mysterious in lots of ways. And I think you do a really good job of tying it up in a way that feels satisfying, when actually you really don't tie up very much at all. I mean, it's still a mystery at the end in many ways. Yeah. You know,
yes,
so
absolutely.
How do you? I mean, I just can't imagine how I would make that work. Do you ever stumble over it, or do you find it just comes to you?
Of course, no. Of course, I do. Of course, I do. You hit a dead end, you come to a point where you think, I don't know what's going to happen next. Of course that happens. Of course that happens. One thing that helps address those concerns is that I'm writing against a ticking clock. If I'm in a hotel room and I have 5 days to myself, and I know that I'm going to go back and go step back into a reality where I'm making dinner and I'm folding laundry and I'm picking up the kids, I am motivated to get that done. I am motivated to capitalize on that time. So that helps. That adds a sense of urgency. And that sense of urgency with respect to this last book was extremely important. Because I think in some ways, the energy of me writing in this almost binge in a hotel room, it still exists in the finished book, I think, even though the finished book bears so little relationship to that first draft. Because I wrote it that way. I wrote it in these crazy circumstances where it was moving so quickly. You can address any of those problems you mentioned when you have all 300 pages in front of you.
Right.
What you can't fix, you know, it's like you can't paint a room that hasn't been built. You have to build the room, and then later the paint job, you know, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still thinking, yeah, but, you know, at what angle are you going to build the walls, and, you know, where do you find the ceiling?
Right.
But
I mean, you definitely get to those moments. The first draft of this book ended with very differently, very, very differently. It ended with Clay and Amanda sitting outside of the house, leaning against the car, prepared to drive away. I forget what had happened at that point in that draft of the book, and the lights in the house went out. And that was right. The end of the book. And my agent and the first editor were both like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, what the fuck is this? And that's a great note from a reader because it's like, oh, right, that's too, it's unfinished. The book is not done. I was building to uncertainty, but that's too much uncertainty. And that was really helpful. And then I was able to sort of recalibrate. And at some point, I realized, I think it might have been at that draft, I realized that I needed the book to end on a question being asked of the reader, or sort of being asked of the circumstances. And so the book ends with a literal question. And I couldn't identify that until I had written that first bad ending.
Yeah. There are so many things that I would love to ask you about the book, but I'm not going to because I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it, but maybe I'll ask you at the end. But it's hugely atmospheric, and one of the things that I really liked about it is that you have these opening chapters before it becomes clear that this is going to be something very sinister that's happening. But in the opening chapters you spend quite a lot of time kind of establishing the atmosphere of a family holiday in a way that's very, very unrushed and very sort of tantalizing. It feels like you really gave that some space. Is that something you were conscious of, and how do you go about building that kind of atmosphere?
Yes, I think that I was absolutely by design. It's a seduction. It's meant to fool the reader into thinking that you've got one kind of book. And you think, I hope you think, oh, this is a book about an unhappy marriage, or a family secret, or a family kind of unraveling or coming together over the course of a holiday, because that's the convention of the literature. And so you recognize it, I think. But I would also say that I think that there is something, even though the pacing of those early chapters is sort of like languid and kind of lush, there's also a lot of menace in those chapters. And it goes back to the only tool that any writer has to work with, which is language. The language is very strange. The first word of the book is a kind of qualifying well, a sort of like, you don't know who's saying this to you, like whether it's God who's sort of saying, like, well, the sun was shining. But it sets you up to think, okay, well, the sun is shining, but the book is saying, well, so something is wrong. And all of the metaphors have to do with, or all of the observation, that there's a piece of a Band-Aid wrapper because children are always cutting themselves, or that the windows are tinted to keep cancer at bay, or that she goes shopping and everything she buys is sort of like organic food that's wrapped up in plastic. It's all really menacing. And also some of the word choice is extremely elevated. A word like talus, which refers to like a pile of gravel at the base of a hill, which is a word I learned in the geology class I was required to take in order to get a Bachelor of Arts degree, as someone writing fiction. I think the language is provocative and the observation is dark. I mean, I could have said that the windows of the car were tinted like a presidential limousine, or like a starlet's sunglasses, or like a certain kind of crystal ashtray popular in the 1970s. But I said it was tinted because they want to keep cancer at bay, and it establishes something. It does something, I think, I hope, in the mind of the reader that you may or may not be fully conscious of.
I mean, it establishes a little bit of fear, a little bit of caution, and a little bit of a sense of risk. And I think there's some, there are some really interesting descriptions of the children as well, and how, slightly uneasy descriptions of the children as they're kind of in this burgeoning adolescence, and that nods to their future. And then, of course, you know, we learn that their future is maybe going to look different to yeah. how their parents might have hoped. Again, I'm going to stop there because I don't want to spoil it for anyone. But one thing I noticed was, so it's very typical of writers to use the close third person where they can sort of tell the reader what the characters are thinking or feeling as a scene unfolds. But it's not so common to do what you've done, which is to hop from one perspective to another within the same scene. Why did you want to do that? And also, how difficult was it? Because I think there's always a risk with that, that it could become confusing for the reader or feel disjointed in some way.
That's a great question. So that is a tool that I use to solve a problem that my editor pointed out to me, which is that the key to the book is the characters don't know what's happening. And the problem is that therefore then neither does the reader. And there's a point it crosses about a third of the way through the book where it stops being kind of tantalizing and starts being really irritating because the reader needs more clarity, because a book has to reward the reader's attention, and withholding that reward is just annoying. And yeah. it's akin to writing a murder mystery and never saying who the killer was. It's breaking a contract that exists between the text and the reader. And I thought that's really useful to think about. And this perspective shift, because originally the book just favored the perspectives of the adults and it simply talked very deeply into their perspectives. And as you say, that's really the dominant mode of most of the fiction that we are seeing these days, that we read about a fictional he or she, but the voice is so situated in their psyche that it may as well be an I. Mm-hmm. Because it's able to watch the he or the she, but talk about the taste of the tea in their cup.
Yeah.
Which is not something that the third person is usually able to afford. What I did was simply something very old-fashioned, which is to write from this sort of like almost Dickensian, Victorian, godly perspective and be able to know absolutely everything that was happening at all times among these six people, and indeed all over the world. And so where I wanted the book to simply fill in the gaps for the reader, I just had the book turn to the reader and say, oh, they're wrong about what's happening, and here's what's happening. Or they don't know that this thing is about to befall them. It was kind of an amazing solution once I figured out I could do it. And to me, I think I was having the most fun as a writer when I was writing those sections.
Yeah, and I think that's so, it's so important, those details, those, you know, and they're almost, you could almost kind of blink and you miss them, references to like, actually, you know, what they have heard is X, and actually what is happening in Minnesota is blah, 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 you know, and but I found those are like little life rafts for the reader to cling yeah. onto as you're going through yeah. it. And you feel like, you know, they're horrifying, some of those details, but they at least give you a sense of some vague understanding of what's that. And I think that's how you manage to finish the book in a way that's kind of open-ended, but still feels satisfying, because I think we know just enough to at least have a good guess at what is going to happen here.
Yeah, I think so.
It's very clever. And I know you've been interviewed about this book a million times before you've spoken to me, and a lot of the interviews would have focused on the fact that it came out during the pandemic, which I guess was an unintended thing. But, you know, when I was reading it, I found it a very unsettling read, although also completely addictive. But I was very glad that I hadn't read it back in the, I guess it wasn't actually published at this point, but in the very early days of the pandemic, when we were all kind of living in this horrible unknown, this like very sinister unknown. I think it would have pushed me over the edge actually at that point. But but yeah, it's interesting how much you've tapped into that kind of feeling that so many of us have touched on.
I mean, I'm so honored when people say that, but I would also point out that like that's what art is. Like art is really a tool that you as the reader or viewer or whether you're watching a movie or whatever, you're using it to make sense of your reality in that moment. And so it's not unlike when people talk about reading 1984 to make sense of the Trump era in the United States, or the surveillance era of big technology. George Orwell could not have conceived of Amazon or Alexa, whatever Amazon's Google Home. George Orwell didn't imagine that stuff. What he imagined was something else, but it's applicable to the person who is freaked out by the fact that they talked about like how they need to buy a high chair, and then their phone started advertising high chairs to them, which happens, right? Hasn't that happened to you? Yeah, it
Oh, for
happens all the
sure, all the
time.
time, yeah. Publishing can be quite unforgiving of manuscripts that don't sit clearly in one genre, and I think Leave the World Behind is a book that, it's literary, it's also a thriller, I guess. There are moments where I was like, oh no, it's a horror. although, I was glad that that wasn't all the way through. I managed to just about keep myself together. Did that tone take any work to get it right?
I think I understood what the aspiration was, but you're quite right that publishing doesn't always know what to do with those texts that are sort of sit between comfortable modes. And one of the biggest concerns about this, but this was not, there was a lot of trepidation about the publication of this book internally among the team of people I publish with. The principal concern was the presidential election in the United States. So we were planning the publication of this book in January of 2019. And I, oh no, excuse me, January of 2020. God, the time, isn't it funny? Time is like so broken in my head. We were planning it for October, for the fall of 2020. And the big concern was the election, that it was going to be such a big election. It was going to, sort of consume all of our attention span, and that was a terrible time to publish a book. And I felt that I didn't care. I was like, I don't want to wait on it. And I, my feeling also was like, well, if Trump is reelected, I'm not going to wait 4 years. You know what I mean? Like, I can't outwait that. And then to bury the book in the spring after he's elected or inaugurated just seems like terrible. Like, let's just do it. So that was the first kind of conversation. And then the second conversation was after COVID. It's like, is this book too, is there something, is it too close to the bone in this uncertain moment to publish this frightening book? And even prior to that, before we were even scheduling the book, when I first was handing it in, there was this conversation about like, well, what is this? How do we market it? Do we market this as a thriller and give it the kind of mainstream publicity push when it's so clearly also a literary novel, which is also a genre, I always like to point out, in terms of its use of language or in terms of its sort of opacity about what's actually happening in the plot. Like, you expect that from a literary novel. You can have a literary novel about a marriage that sort of ends abruptly and doesn't really tell you how things resolve, and you accept that because it's a convention of the genre. So I was sort of disobeying conventions of two different genres or smashing them together, and there was a lot of concern. It was a lot of and justifiable too, because what we're talking about is marketing and money and how you communicate directly with the right audience for the book. But in the end, I'm sure there are readers who are confounded. I'm sure there are people who read horror, as you mentioned, who read this book and are irritated because it doesn't really deliver as a novel of horror. And I'm sure there are people who read literary fiction who read the book and were irritated because it turned out to be sort of scary or interested in plot or kind of grotesque at times.
No, I think it's for me it was just the right amount of all of those things. But yeah, I
Oh,
guess
good.
it's
It's like making a cocktail. You want to get the proportions exactly right, you know?
Exactly, yeah. This may be a terrible compliment to give somebody, but I also love the length of the book. It's about 240 pages, and I always think there's something really delightful about picking up a good book that is not 450 pages long or 600 pages long. I hope that's not an irritating thing to say.
I think that there is a real problem of inflation in the contemporary novel.
Really?
I do. I think that novels are too long. I think Ted Hughes talked about this with respect to the typewriter. So this is a conversation that's quite old, that like, if the technology is guiding the creation, then it's very difficult to say, like, is this right or is this wrong? Did the typewriter make it too easy to write at length? And did the computer make it too easy to write at still greater length? I think there are, because I work as a critic a fair amount. I think I've stopped saying this in my criticism because at this point it's just sort of, I get it, but like most of the books that I see are too long.
Mm.
And there are some writers who are much more sort of predisposed to economy, and there are occasional really beautiful long novels that are absolutely just like astonishing to sink into and just a marvel. But I think that generally a lot of books could stand to go on a diet.
Yeah. I wonder whether people have a feeling of, I don't know, that it's not important enough if it's not long or something, or that...
Oh, of course they do. Yeah. That's 100% what it is. And that sort of reaffirms how the fallacy of what we're saying, because if you're, then the book is just padded, and there are so many, I mean, Katsia is a great example. I don't know if you've read Disgrace. Disgrace is such a slender book, and it's astonishing.
Yeah.
Astonishing. Like a masterpiece. So tight. Patrick Modiano, one of my favorite living writers. Those books are tiny, very, very tiny. You can read one in an afternoon, and they're bottomless pits. They are like, they look like puddles, and they turn out to be oceans, you know? The idea that length correlates to significance is so juvenile. It's such an error.
I love that. They look like puddles. Is there anything that you found or continue to find particularly challenging as a writer?
Yeah. The entire task is a challenge. finding the discipline to show up, right?
Mm.
That's not easy. Real life intrudes. Landing on something that feels worth your time and worth your reader's time, that's not easy, because every story's been told. So it's really simple to say, oh, I'm going to write this great family romance, this family, you know, this, I would write a great family novel. And then you read like a Tessa Hadley and you're like, shit, well, she did it so much better. Why would I ever even bother? You know, or saying like, I want to write a novel that sort of weds the political and the personal. And then you read Katsia and you're like, well, fuck, I can't do that. Like I'll never do it this well. So why would I bother? And I think, you know, getting out of that headspace of comparison, especially when you're talking about Tessa Hadley and J.M. Katsia, you know, forget it. Like, that's not easy. That's not easy for somebody on a first book, on a third book, on a, you know, it's never going to be easy. And being able to commit to a story and let it take its time and see it through, because it takes a lot of time. I mean, I'm not someone, I mean, we all have bad days at the computer or at the notebook or wherever you are. We all have those days where it's like, oh, it's just not happening today. But generally speaking, that's not my problem. It's not my problem to produce the sentences and, you know, let my mind wander and let my imagination go free. But it takes a lot. There's a lot more involved than that. There's a lot of discipline involved in bringing it all together and making sense of it as a cohesive whole. That's hard work. It's hard work. And it's not hard work in the way that like being a nurse is hard work. So then it's sort of difficult to kind of complain about, or it's difficult to feel, it can be difficult to feel like, oh, the labor has been worth it, because it's just sort of this private indulgence until it becomes a public thing.
Is there any piece of writing advice that you've received over the years, or it might be a note from an editor, or anything that you've kind of learned that has really improved your writing?
The extent to which my writing has improved is an open question that I cannot answer. But I will say that I think it has been very useful for me. I have a very good friend who's also a novelist. Her name is Lynn Stagerstrong. She's an amazing writer. One of the things that we talk about a lot is the reader. I think you'd be surprised, or I've been surprised now since having this revelation, how certain writers never speak about the reader and never think about what the book is intended to provide. Yes, the book is intended to convey. Every writer has, they have a point, they have a message, whether it's political or aesthetic or spiritual or whatever. There's a reason they're creating the fiction they're creating. But their fundamental responsibility is to the reader and her pleasure. Books should be a pleasure. They only really work when they're a pleasure. And you can define pleasure very broadly. There are readers who find Virginia Woolf at her most difficult, or William Gaddis, or you know, James Joyce, to be extraordinarily pleasurable. And I actually love Gaddis, so I understand that. And then there are readers whose definition of pleasure is Danielle Steele or Barbara Cartland, and I think that that's fine, that's valid. There are multiple ways to be pleased, just as you can like chocolate ice cream or you can like vanilla ice cream. But I think you have to understand as the writer what your reader wants, whether she wants chocolate or vanilla, and what you're giving her. If she wants vanilla ice cream and you're serving her, you know, the ingredients for ice cream but not the ice cream itself, then you haven't done your job. And I think that a novel has to, specific to fiction, right? I think a novel has to reward certain, you know, it has to obey certain rules. And if it breaks those rules, it has to have a reason for breaking them. And the reason has to be as pleasurable as when they're unbroken. So I think that that has been something that has really changed how I think about my work, which is to think about what the reader's expectations are.
Yeah.
To think about how to toy with them, but how to also deliver something to that reader nonetheless. But again, we talked earlier about like books being too long. I think this has a lot to do with it. It's like, I don't want sentences to accrue when they're not in service of like pulling me through the book. Sometimes I do want the writer who's a brilliant writer and observer to stop and describe the light on the icicle. Sometimes that's what you want, and sometimes that's really perfect. But sometimes it's just the writer working without discipline,
yeah,
and forgetting about story and forgetting about that a book is a machine and the machine has to pull you through it.
Yeah. My dad's an academic writer, and he always says, I don't know if he got this from someone, easy writing makes for hard reading or something like that, which I think he means like it's not your job to have a great time necessarily while you're writing it, but it's your job to think about how readable and pleasurable and compelling it's going to be for the person reading it.
There's something about storytelling that like, and again, I think when you say storytelling, it makes people think of like children's books or simplicity. And I don't think that's what it's about. I mean, I've just reviewed Jonathan Franzen's new book, Crossroads, which is massive. Definitely a book that is way too long, at least 140 pages too long. But it's sort of hard to believe what a good teller of story he is.
Yeah.
That he can pull out of the main thrust of the novel and fill in a character's entire biography in a way that's so beautifully done. It's so such a pleasure to read, an absolute pleasure to read. And, you know, in this country, you know, he's definitely, I think, considered one of the best. And part of it is that he really knows how to tell a good story.
Mm.
And when you look at the very great literary writers who I think are working today, Colson Whitehead, Louise Erdrich, Kazuo Ishiguro, these are great tellers of stories. Those books are all great stories. And that is There's something important there. There's something really important there.
And when you look at your writing life so far, since you started writing novels, what do you feel the most proud of?
I don't know. I don't know. I'll tell you. I got, it's the relationships I have with other writers who I consider truly great. And the notion that they would ever consider me at all engaged in the business that they are in. I just got a copy of a book from a writer, I won't say who, but a writer who is older than me, quite a bit older than me, who I adore and have adored my entire career. It's entirely possible, and in fact, really probably plausible, that this writer's publisher has like a publicity assistant who liked my book and said, hey, you know what? You should send a copy to this person. I don't care. Even if that's the reason, I don't care. Getting this book directly from this person in their home, sending it to me from their home with a note just saying, I wanted you to have this, is so, so meaningful to me. Truly, like, I actually blows my mind. And it's one of those things where you, it's like, God, I wish I could go back in time and tell the 20-year-old who was reading this writer's work that someday you'll get a book from them as a gift. It blows my mind. Incredible.
Huge thanks to Ruman Alam for being such a brilliant and frank final guest of this series. If you haven't read Leave the World Behind, then I'm certain that you'll want to now. So head over to the In Writing shop at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing to buy it in paperback. That URL is in the show notes too. This episode was sponsored by The Novelry, where writers coach writers. The Novelry is offering a 20% discount on their online writing course, The Big Idea, for listeners of In Writing. This short course is perfect for beginners or writers in need of fresh inspiration who'd like to write a page-turning story. Enter the code INWRITING20 at checkout on thenovelry.com. That's it for me now, and I'm hoping to spend the next few months concentrating on my creative writing MA and my journalism work, so it might be a little while until there's another full series of In Writing. I want to say thank you to all the guests and all the sponsors of this series, and I'm mostly just so grateful to every single listener, whether you've just listened to this episode or whether you've been listening to them all. Also to all the very kind people who have shared the podcast on social media or sent it to friends, and even a couple of teachers who've put it on their student reading lists or listening lists. I feel very, very lucky. Hopefully you'll hear from In Writing again soon, but for now, good luck with your writing and take care.